All right. Hi, my friends. Welcome to another episode of We Used to Be Best Friends. I am your host, Sabrina. And on today's episode, we have a very special guest. I follow her on TikTok for quite a while, and she has been brave enough to share a lot of her experience dealing with narcissistic abuse. And she has used all of that education to educate us on narcissistic abuse. She is a CPTSD, narcissistic abuse, and trauma educator. Please welcome Kelly Conrad.
Woo! Hello. Thank you so much for having me. This will be fun.
This is going to be fun. So on today's episode, we're diving deep into discussing covert narcissists. I know I experienced a covert narcissist, but I kind of want my audience to learn a little bit more of what truly is deep down a covert narcissist. So what would you say to that?
So the thing about a covert narcissist is they are very sneaky. They're very quiet. They're very unassuming. It's very insidious.
Yes.
One of the best things I ever learned from my very good friend, Alex Daniel, she was on TikTok. She's not anymore. But she's a therapist, and she said the thing about people with that truly have NPD, not just the traits, is that when you're dealing with a more overt, grandiose narcissist, that's their personality. So the way that they present themselves, show up in the room, they're either overt and grandiose or more covert and vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And the subtype, whether it's like, you know, communal or malignant, or that's how they manipulate. And so covert narcissists are very sneaky because your limbic system feels that something is wrong, but you don't know what it is. It's like this thing that lurks in the shadows, and you're like, do I have this right? Like this person, I don't know. Like they don't do anything super.
Exactly. Yeah. You can't put your finger on it.
And that's the danger of them, is because they slowly creep through the night and slowly start manipulating your world and your worldview.
Yep.
Your brain and your relationships. And then eventually you wake up one day and you're like, what the hell happened?
Exactly. Yeah. Oh my God. You explained it like perfectly. I mean, I've always heard the term death by a thousand cuts or paper cuts or something like that. And you don't realize it's happening to you until A, you're out of it, and B, you're still suffering from it a year, 2 years later. I feel like with a covert narcissist, they do these things that are so minuscule, so small, that when you do explain it to somebody else or you talk about it to somebody else, it is so small that other people are going to logically look at you and be like, oh, well, maybe you're being too oversensitive on this, or maybe you're looking too close into this. But they don't realize that it's like all of these little things that end up piling up later down the line. Do you think that that's true?
Well, yeah, because they are dangerous, but not in the way that society would like coin danger. So when we think about like, oh, they're really dangerous, you're going to think about a more textbook, you know, really malignant type narcissist that's capable of really overt abuse. And maybe they have some antisocial parts where they don't have issues committing crimes. There's like a severe lack of empathy. There might even be some like psychopathy. Like those are your more malignant narcissistic type people. And I think a lot of society thinks when they hear that word, they think, oh, it's such an overused word, or like a true narcissist is only somebody that's like, you know, like harming animals and doing all these things. And like, yes,
no.
That is
Yeah.
true. And they can also show up in a very deeply psychological warfare type way, where the person, they're not overtly doing anything to you specifically, but the internal war that's happening inside of you, you're doubting yourself. You're questioning your sanity. You start to feel less than as a person. You start to, you're allowing them to push your boundaries in ways that feel, it feels weird to you. Like it's very unassuming. And I find personally, like my experience with covert narcissists is that they punish. They punish you in this very like weird way. And they are the type that are more likely to discard you. Like,
yes,
they very slowly devalue. You don't really know what's going on. Whereas like an overt narcissist, they're just kind of like, they're out there. You kind of see it coming. But they will discard when they're done with you. They discard quick and like they're out.
Yep. 100%. What would you say, how do they punish you? Like, can you explain that a little bit further?
Yeah. So they do things to sabotage. They're masters at sabotaging. So they,
God. Sorry. I'm like relating to this so much. So keep going.
Yeah, they're the masters of sabotage. They're excellent at pitting people against each other, and they don't really, the two people that are being pitted against one another don't really see what's happening. And the covert narc is just sitting on the sidelines like, yep. And once again, I have avoided accountability and played the victim like such a perfect little actress or actor. And the two people that are being pitted against each other don't see what's happening. And that's, covert narcissists are experts at distractions. They should put on their resume, I am an expert at creating distractions, so that no one figures out that I'm actually the person that's causing the problem.
Wow. I'm sorry. I'm like in awe. I know you guys can't see my face right now, but I'm in awe because like you just described what I went through literally to a T.
Wow.
My ex-best friend was narcissistic and I didn't know she was a covert narcissist. I didn't know any of that stuff back then. But the moment I started dating my boyfriend, she flipped. Things were weird. It would start off being like how much she hated him, how much she can't stand him. Anytime I'd come home from a date, like super excited. Oh my God, so we did this, we did this. He's not my boyfriend anymore. He's my fiance now. I have to get used to that. Thank you. But she would kind of start to use words that I would tell her like, oh, so we went to this restaurant, or he took out my chair, or he got me flowers. And she'd be like, oh, he did that. Oh, you went to that restaurant. Okay. And then it started to slowly creep in where it's like, I felt something was weird. I felt unsafe telling her. She would twist it to make it sound very negative and slowly would make it sound as if he was toxic and treating me badly when he wasn't. He's actually one of the healthiest relationships I've ever been in my life. and then when that wasn't enough and she was trying so hard to get me to dump him, when that wasn't enough, she brought in my roommate and started to convince him that my fiance was treating her badly when my fiance wouldn't even look at her. There was one specific moment where I invited her to come to like our little apartment. This was during COVID, and she was trying so hard to flirt with him right in front of me. Like, oh my God, ha ha ha, he's so funny, oh my God. While at the same time telling me how much she hates this man, but is flirting with him. And I didn't know then that she was baiting him, trying to get him to flirt back with her, but he didn't. Every time he'd come up to me, give me a kiss on the cheek, or like get me something to drink, like kind of just acknowledge her, but ignore her. And then we got back to the apartment, to her apartment. And she flipped, full flip, started screaming at me. I can't believe you invited me. You're a horrible friend. You knew I hated him, and yet you still forced me to come to this like barbecue. And I'm standing there like literally half an hour ago, you're chuckling with my boyfriend. You're basically flirting with him. And now you're yelling at me for forcing you when I never forced you. And I'm sitting here like, what the absolute F? And then it got even worse because she started bringing in my friend who is my roommate. Sorry, context, I lived with her and my roommate, but during COVID, I was living with my boyfriend. So I was separated, just thank God. And she brought him in, started telling him some sort of story. He then comes to me, tells me he doesn't want my boyfriend around because apparently he's harassing her. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? The man doesn't even look at her. And when he does look at her in her direction, she flips it and makes it sound like he's harassing her. And I felt like I was living in a Lifetime movie the entire time. Like, somebody's going to put me in, like, the, I don't know what they're called, but when you go to the mental institute and they put you in that straitjacket. Because yeah. I thought I was the crazy one. I was like, am I going insane? Probably. I don't know. But sorry, that was like a mouthful, but no. That's what I experienced.
This is what you said to sum it up for people that are listening. Narcissistic people, especially covert narcissists, are experts at making you believe, constructing a narrative to make you believe that your reaction to their behavior is the problem, not that their behavior is the problem. And that is one of their key pieces in the playbook around staying in that victim vulnerable role. Covert narcissists are more attuned to being a professional victim. That's like their favorite pastime.
Yes.
They will create situations. This is all part of the manipulation. Like, it's not even just that they do something outwardly and then they avoid accountability. They will actually create situations using triangulation, gaslighting, to be the victim so that you end up kind of standing on the sidelines feeling like, okay, hold up. Like, you come to this party, you're doing all this shady stuff, she's doing all this shady stuff, and then she has the audacity to yell at you and accuse you of being the problem for taking her to this party. Like, these are the kind of things that they do. And it's so unhealthy and so, it's very dismantling for the person that it's happening to the victim, because you really don't see it for what it is. And that's part of, like in the romantic relationship, you know, we become more trauma bonded to them. We become more dependent on them. But with this friendship, it's less about that. And it's more about this like lurking thing in the shadows where you find yourself like rewriting text messages to them because you're like, oh, if I say that, that's going to set her off. Or, you know, you don't bring up certain things, or even if they're like, if you're having a conversation with them and they're saying like, one of the things they love to do is like talk really, really, really badly about people behind their back. Like there's like, like literal no empathy in these conversations. And you learn through their conditioning of you, cause that's what they're doing. They're conditioning us to like, they're controlling us. So we don't react because we're like internally very afraid of the backlash or the punishment that will come from the reaction, whether it's the outright explosion that she had or the silent treatment. The
I got that a lot. Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, the yelling only happened when I started living with her. The silent treatment, the ghosting, happened a lot throughout the relationship. It was like sometimes months of completely disappearing. And then, you know, I'd reach out. I'd be like, hey, is everything okay? Blah, blah, blah. Let's talk. And it's just It was just very strange. But I felt the silent treatment more when I lived with her, because she was dead right walking past my door as if I did not exist. Weirdest shit ever.
Well, and that's part of the psychological warfare, is that kind of behavior. It isn't normal. It's not a normal part of a healthy relationship. Now, if you were in a relationship with a person, you're living with a person, there was an argument, and that particular person, you know, if we get into attachment styles, which is a whole other conversation, but let's say the person says, hey, I am more avoidant, and this is in my head because that's the video that I was recording before I went on this podcast. Like, if you're more avoidant, closeness and conflict feels really dangerous to your limbic system. So if somebody says, like, hey, you know, can I think about this for just like an hour? And like I really want to like thoughtfully come back to the conversation. Like, that's an appropriate response, but they will make their presence very known. Like, hey, remember I'm here, but remember I'm not talking to you because I'm controlling the narrative and I'm controlling your emotions, controlling everything. And what ends up happening for victims is this internal chaos is so uncomfortable to live with. So what we end up doing is we betray ourselves. We don't set a boundary. We don't see what's happening. And we end up apologizing to them for the very thing that they did, because our limbic system gets wired to learn that to be safe, we have to keep the peace with them to keep the relationship going.
Yeah.
That's the danger of a covert narc. Like, very dangerous.
Yeah. But it also, with the triangulation on top of that, it was like, not only was I dealing with the silent treatment from her, but I was also dealing with the silent treatment from my friend, who was my roommate. He was my friend first. So it was like a double whammy, both of them ignoring me. I just remember being like, I don't know what to do in this situation, like completely lost.
Well, she scapegoated you, is what she did.
Through
the triangulation, she's maintaining control of the narrative, so that she's able to punish you by not talking to you. But now you've got your roommate, also thinking you're the problem. She's successfully like scapegoated you in a way that keeps control of the whole narrative, so that if this thing collapses on her, like if you're like, oh my God, I'm calling you out, like I know what you're doing, this is where they pull, like think of it like they just pull a deck of cards out, and it's like, oh no, I have the permanent victim card. I'm announcement, everybody, I'm always the victim.
Wow. Yep. Wow. I did confront her, and that card was pulled. Oh, I'm trying to help you get out of a bad relationship. I was there for you, but you're too blind. You don't want to see it. He's the one who's harassing me. I was just literally, I'm like, this is crazy. I'm on Shutter Island. Please, like, what is happening? But I didn't, at that time, I did not know that was narcissistic abuse. I did not know what emotional abuse looked like. I did not know what psychological abuse looked like. So after all of that happened, I went to therapy like almost a year later, because I was still suffering from symptoms. Then my therapist told me what I was going through. And then it all clicked because I started doing a lot of research and then found you guys on TikTok.
Well, and that's really common. Like, there are a lot of, you know, not everybody has my lens where, you know, I'm from the family system and I'm the scapegoat and on and on and on and on. But there are a lot of people in the community that's exactly how it went down for them, whether it's a friend or a coworker or, you know, more often a romantic relationship, but not always, where it's new, it's insidious, it's confusing. It leaves you feeling like there's something really, really wrong with you. Like, there's something wrong with you, that you did something to cause it. Like, it just lurks in the back of your head. And then once people start to learn about abuse dynamics specifically,
yeah,
and they realize, like, it's not just this super overt power and control, beating people up kind of thing. Like, that's one of my favorite books that I've read along my journey is Women Who Love Psychopaths by Sandra L. Brown. It's an excellent book. It's a little clinical for people that are not really into, like, the clinical nerdism of it. It might be. I loved it because I'm all about the clinical nerdism, but she brings up this very valid point, and I think it's something that every person needs to kind of realize, is that when we're growing up and we're going to school and we're learning about the world, like, there's not posters in medical offices or on the wall that say, do you think you're being emotionally manipulated? Call 725 for more help. Like, there's nothing like that.
There's nothing there. Yeah.
They don't teach us these things. It's not common knowledge. It's not something that is talked about. And people with these type of, you know, more pathological, pervasive personality disorders, especially in the cluster B family, they're actually banking on people not understanding it. They don't want people to find out about it. It's like the secret that they don't want told, right?
Yes, but the less education you have, you don't know it's happening to you while it's happening.
Exactly. And that's the danger. That's the danger. So that's why podcasts like these and platforms like ours are so important, because there are so many people out there that are being actively abused and manipulated, and they don't know what they're looking at.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the abuse cycle. Could you talk a little bit more on covert narcissists and how they use that abuse cycle, and what are the steps, or the cycle steps, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the traditional abuse cycle of the narcissist is pretty much, you know, the map of love bombing idolization. That is where they are going to give you that's where they set up the intermittent reinforcement, the reward system of the brain, where they're able to give us less and less over time. We call it breadcrumbing, just to get back to that idolization stage. That's the dopamine hit. That's the point of it. And then after you've gone through this reward, they very slowly devalue us. So covert narcissists don't devalue people in the overt sense. That's why it's very sneaky. It's very emotional. It's one of the best things I've ever heard is they don't have to yell at you. They just have to whisper, and it has the same impact on the system. They don't have to say very much at all, but your limbic system goes, and so as soon as you start to feel that devalue, you desperately want to get back to the idolization. So you fawn, you don't say certain things, you do the things that they want so they can maintain that control. But if you attempt to set a boundary, if you take something from them, heck, in friendships with the more possessive covert narcissistic people, if you spend too much time with someone else, or they decide that, you know, you got a new bag and you shouldn't have that new bag, it should be my bag, so I'm going to get a better bag than you, they will put you through punishment. And the punishment in their discard is silence, sometimes for a day, sometimes for a week, sometimes for a month, sometimes longer, until one of two things happen. You apologize to them so that they can regain the control, or this is the favorite suck you back in, the Hoover of the covert narcissist. Alert, cue emotional crisis, cue health crisis, cue breakup. Alert, I've lost my job. No, I didn't really. I got fired, but I need all this sympathy because I'm a victim. That's what they do. And then you, in your mind, run back to them unknowingly thinking, oh no, like, her father's passed away. Oh no, her cat died. Oh no, her favorite mug was broken by some psychopathic person. Whatever they think they can hoover you back in with, that's what they'll use every single time, so that the attention on them again.
Hers was sexual assault and harassment. Oh, that was the storyline. Yeah. She probably told me over 6 or 7 men that did that. And for me, if she lied about certain things that she has told me, that is beyond me. Because that's insane, talking about sexual assault like that. But the only reason why I now think that they could have been lies is how she made my fiance seem like he's harassing her when he wasn't and make everyone else believe it. So it was like that storyline that she used over and over and over again.
That, and that's that. That right there is a very, very, very dangerous covert narcissist, because that is a person that isn't just manipulating emotions and, you know, being sneaky. It's a person who is constructing false narratives, which is what they do. And they do it in a variety of ways, but she's constructing a false narrative to target someone and scapegoat them under the guise of a crime.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
That they admit. That's dangerous.
It's crazy to me, because there are some instances, and this is not like a joke to talk about. I've experienced it. So this is like something that's near and dear to many, many women who have actually experienced it. It's not something that's easy to heal from, period. But there was one instant where there was a tennis coach at her college that was caught for harassing the girls on the team. And these were a lot of girls that we knew. She's on the team with them, so she clearly knew them. But I knew them from passing, but not really close friends. And I just remember having the conversation with her, and I was livid. I was like, how can he do that to these girls? Like, how? Like, angry, like wanting to punch a wall. And she just dismissed it. Yeah, I mean, he never did anything to me. And I just remember in that moment, my entire body just being like, what? Like, how is she, especially since she's told me all of these different stories, how are you reacting in that way? How are you not anything? Like, I don't know. It's just so strange to me when you've experienced someone like that in real life. It makes no sense in my brain.
Well, it's because I'll tell you why it doesn't make sense to you. And it's the thing that doesn't make sense to a lot of victims, because they are void of empathy. That's a huge part of the problem, right? Is that at best they can learn cognitive empathy so they can understand what it is, but they don't have emotional or compassionate empathy. So for people who have true empathy, it seems completely asinine and like just evil that a person could be that dismissive of someone's experience. But that's the thing about the covert narc, is they are not concerned about other people's experiences. They are only concerned about their experiences and what serves them. So if the tennis coach harassing somebody serves her and she finds a way to make it, it gives her supply, or it gives her, that fuel for that victim mentality. Oh, then she'll care about it out the wahoo. That's why, you know,
that's messed up.
Communal type narcissists are very dangerous, because they use their community status and their do good things to look like this spectacular human being. And meanwhile, they are the most abusive, evil species on the planet, and no one sees it. Yeah.
Wow. That, like, to me, that's just pure cruelty. That's insanity. Insanity. And they'll get away with it, because I've had friends come up to me and be like, I would never think that that person would hurt a fly, because they're so sweet, so innocent, and, oh my God, I didn't know, so ditzy and blind, like, all the time. So it's just, I don't know, evil, I guess.
Well, and that's the danger, right? Like, I mean, even in my romantic relationship, like when I first started to connect dots, and, you know, my situation was incredible in the grand scheme of things, because, you know, I was an immigrant and I was trapped in the States in the pandemic and stuff. But when I first started to connect dots, and Peggy was away on a business trip, and I was over at our friend's house, and we were drinking and having fun, and I can't remember what happened, but I just, something triggered me, and I started crying, and I was like, you guys, sometimes he gets, like, really angry at me, like, and I'm not talking, like, just a little bit mad, like, I was starting to connect dots, and, you know, like, I basically said, I'm really scared that he's abusive. I'm really scared that he's being abusive. And the girl, oh, this kills me when I tell this story. She's listening. She's taking it seriously. Her husband is like, oh my gosh, you know, like, I think he's been lying about therapy and all this kind of thing. And she says, she drops this line. And this is what happens to victims all the time, people. She says, well, I mean, I'm not saying that I don't believe you. It's just, I've never seen him act that way. So it's hard for me to believe that he could really be capable of that. And there's the danger, is that covert narcissists, they don't scream from the rooftops. They're not obvious. They are very, very, very careful and calculated in the way that they abuse. And they are relying on that exact narrative that no one else is seeing what you're seeing, so that the victim believes they are crazy.
Yep.
It's so damaging.
It's like the good person persona or mask that they wear. It's insane that they seem so innocent on the outside, but once you live them, they're not.
Yep. It's just, and escaping them is hard. Escaping them is hard. If they don't discard you, like tell me, like, what, how did you figure it out with her? How did you get out of all of it? Because
I got discarded bad.
You got discarded.
thank God. And I at that time had a lot of pride too, where I knew in some deep part of me that I was not wrong about my reality, and that I was being gaslit, and that all of this was like going crazy, that I was not going to go up to her and apologize. There was one weak moment where I came up to her and she'd been ignoring me, and I asked her, hey, we haven't talked in a while. Like, what's going on? And she just fed me some bullshit like, oh, you've been busy and I've been busy. So in my mind, I was like, okay, maybe I'm not putting in enough effort. So I was like, well, let's make time. Are you free Friday? Are you free Saturday? Are you blah, blah, blah. No, I'm hanging out with this person. No, I'm hanging out with this person. I'm hanging out with this person. And then that's when it clicked that I was like literally begging for this person to see me and hang out with me when they made all this time with other people and they can't even walk 5 steps to my door. And I think my pride kind of came into place there and was like, never again, Sabrina. Are you going to beg someone to talk to you or to be your friend? If she's going to ignore you the whole time, pretend you don't exist, it's going to hurt, but it is what it is. And
excuse me. This is a good opportunity for me to bring in a little bit of the like more CPTSD lens here for mm-hmm. anybody that you may have complex trauma, you know, has gone through the family system. Narcissistic abuse at a baseline is designed to keep you trauma bonded to them and make you like dependent. That's part of the control. But from a complex trauma lens, especially if there's, depending on your attachment, like I'm disorganized attachment, so I have like the marriage of both. But you become wired to think that it's normal to work very, very, very hard for people's love and approval just to maintain connection. That is huge dangers of this type of abuse, and especially for people who are a little more vulnerable if there's that complex trauma piece. So for someone like me, in my healing and in my rewiring, I've really had to like learn to notice the patterns of any relationship with anyone. And it doesn't need to be a romantic partner. It's a friend. Yeah. it's a family member, it's a work person, a little more complex because work, but still, where I am doing all the emotional labor. I'm the person that's having to twist and bend and flex and back off and then lean in and basically be like, it's mental gymnastics and it's being a contortionist to accommodate this person. That is not a reciprocal healthy relationship. And for people who have a lot of trauma like me, my limbic system is wired to look for that more like intense hit. So a person mm-hmm. that's safe is just kind of boring to me. I'm like, oh, you actually just like talk to me and we talk about things and we connect and it's like normal and we hang out at intervals and nothing ever, you know, nothing really dramatic or like the mic drop moment like doesn't happen. Like, oh, what the hell is that? But I'm not wired for that. So I've had to work really hard at understanding that if it's familiar, if it feels like home, it's probably not where you should be.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so true. So true. I'm starting to experience this in my friendships, but also in my romantic relationship. It's like you think the boring is not fun, but it's actually peaceful where it's consistent and you know what you're getting and it's not like suddenly they're going to throw the wool over your eyes. None of that. It's not supposed to happen. It's supposed to be equal.
Well, a lot of people think, and this was when I learned this, I was like, whoa. A lot of people think that like the butterflies is chemistry. Oh, I have the butterflies with this person. That's your limbic system actually trying to say,
run.
this is no. But if you're wired for that intensity, which I am, I'm very, very attuned to handling like high stake attachment. Like for me, high stakes attachment, I'm wired for that. It's like, this is a game that I know how to play. This is a game that I'm like well versed in. It's a chess game that I understand.
Yeah.
The nervous system is calm. Waters are calm. There's no storm. My limbic system goes, what the hell is that? Like, no. Like, nervous somewhere. And it's so dysfunctional, like saying it out loud like that. Like people are listening, they're probably thinking, who the hell would choose that? And that's the point, is that your limbic system is the most ancient part of your brain. It mm-hmm. is our cortex, which is our thinking brain, which helps us to understand. That's the newer part. That's why humans are, you know, complex. But that limbic system brain, it doesn't have thoughts. It has survival and feelings. I always say in lives to people, I say, when the bus is coming towards you, your prefrontal cortex brain is the one that says, oh, look, there is a bus. It is yellow. It is coming towards me. It is telling you all the information that you need to make a decision. The limbic system is the one that says, excuse me, there is a bus coming towards you. You need to move immediately or you're going to die.
Yeah.
So if you're wired to think that it's normal to be over here in a storm, you don't understand why being over here in the calm sea is actually where you need to be. So you have to train both brains to work together in tandem. That's the key.
Oh my God. That's so true. And how do you think people can train that?
So there's a trauma component in itself. So processing trauma that's stored mm-hmm. in your body, one part of it, that's a lot of like EMDR somatic. But it's recognizing patterns. So it's being able to identify feelings in your body, where you feel them in your body, being able to actually name them and pausing. Like,
yeah,
I did a video a few days ago where I talked about the yellow light. I was like, okay, because people are always asking like, oh, how do I rewire? Like, how do I like notice the healthy relationship? And this is the thing, is that if you think about a traffic light, in the narcissistic relationship, we are trained to just ignore the yellow light. We either speed through it, chasing them. We don't care that we've just run a yellow light. Like, no one cares about that. Or we freeze and we do nothing. Now we're clogging up the intersection. We're not even moving. We're not even going anywhere. So we have to learn to notice when the limbic system says, that's weird. Why is she doing that? Why did he say that? Mm-hmm. Why do I feel like I can't tell them the truth? Wow, they're not showing a lot of empathy. That is your limbic system saying, yellow light. Notice this. Pay attention to me. So once we start really giving that yellow light space, you're rewiring neural pathways. And yeah. The limbic system is going to catch up with this brain, the prefrontal cortex, and go, oh, I see. This behavior that I previously ignored is actually something I need to pay attention to. I need to trust and believe in me and sit with this and learn what this means. It's a pause. A lot of us don't do that. We either freak out and we like freeze or we charge ahead.
It's very true. I do have like a story that kind of relates to that, that just, it popped in my head. I had a very toxic ex that would constantly be like on my weight, and he would only allow me to eat like an apple or water and constantly ask me to send him a picture of the scale every morning. It was a lot. I've met a lot of these people in my life. Okay. So it's insane. And I would catch myself in that relationship always hiding food and eating secretly. And feeling guilty afterwards. There's this one moment with my fiance now that I was heading to my belly dance class, walking down the street. He comes in his car, like pulls down the window. He's like, hey, babe, what you doing? And I happened to have Chick-fil-A in my hand. And I was like eating while I was walking. And he's like, get in the car. I'll drive you to belly dance. And I got in the car and I had this trigger instinct of hiding my food, and immediately in my head was like, he's gonna yell at me like my ex did. He's going to scream at me and tell me that I'm not eating healthy, and that like he's just gonna yell at me that I'm having Chick-fil-A because it's fast food. And I'm sitting there in the car, defense, like I just remember my body was like in defense. I couldn't breathe, nothing. And he looks at me and he's like, oh, I see you got Chick-fil-A. Again, defense. I'm like, yeah, I did. He's like, do you have any fries in there? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, can I have some? And then we sit there sharing the food together while he drives me to belly dance. And that was this moment in my mind where I was like a breath of fresh air, where I recognized what I experienced was so very toxic that it produced in my, like, I expected him to yell at me and he didn't. I expected him to behave like that ex and he didn't. And it was that one healing moment that I was like, wow, this is what healthy relationship looks like. And it's insane until you experience it.
And that is a beautiful example. I mean, it's terrible. It's not a beautiful example in terms of that was your reality, but it is a beautiful example of what this abuse does to the brain. Mm-hmm. And what it does to your trauma responses, because a lot of people will say, you know, like, oh, well, you know, that's irrational, or he wouldn't do that, or, you know, you're not in an emergency, like, just calm down. And people don't realize that trauma responses are not a choice. Your limbic system is your smoke detector, guys. Like, it's the thing that smells the problem before there's a problem. And the problem with people like us who have gone through this abuse is that smoke detector can fire when there's perceived threat or real threat. So we don't necessarily know which one is what. And so for you with the story, your smoke detector remembered that you eating food, you doing a basic human need, was something that could be dangerous for you. Mm-hmm. And so now you're behaving in this way that is, you know, maladaptive. It's a maladaptive behavior. But it was also a moment for you to realize that was a yellow light for you, where you went, holy crap. Like, I'm hiding food. Like, if I ever want to hide food from a person, for real though, that's your yellow light. That's like, hiding food is not a normal thing to do. That having to hide food means that you feel like you're in danger. And any person going forward for you, where you ever have that feeling of, I have to hide this, that's where you stop and go, am I feeling this way because of a previous relationship? Am I triggered? Or is this happening because my nervous system is saying, this person isn't actually safe for you?
Yeah.
It could be either, but it's still pause, guys. Like, pause and listen to your body. Listen to those cues. They're there. Yes, they're maladaptive for people like me who is, like, I'm deeply traumatized and I have, you know, disproportionate reactions to things, but I understand the why. So that's funny. Your story made me think of when I was still with Peggy. He controlled like me. Like, if he could control when I breathed in and out, he would have. But he was really controlling with like food as well and drinking. He had this like rigid rule that you were not allowed to drink between Sunday and Thursday, which, you know, some people might say like, oh, well, that's not a bad rule. Like, don't drink during the week. But the thing about it was on Friday and Saturday, he would, or we would then drink the equivalent of 4 times the amount that somebody could drink in a normal week, just be having a healthy relationship with alcohol. And so I said to him once, I was like, dude, what is the difference between me having a glass of wine with my friend on Tuesday and having 4 bottles of wine at the winery where we ruin our entire Sunday? Like, what's the difference between the two? And he, you know, he wouldn't take accountability for it. He wouldn't answer. And so what I've told people is I was so pissed off at my lack of agency. Like, I had no autonomy. I started sneaking secret drinks. Like, I would make secret drinks when he was in the shower. And it wasn't even necessarily that I wanted the booze. It wasn't about that. It was that I was so angry that I couldn't be an adult that got to make my own decisions. And so I felt like I eyed this drink that I didn't even want. And that was like that combined with 800 other things. I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, you're 43 years old and you're hiding a drink from your husband. If you're not an alcoholic, what the hell are you doing? Like, but these are the behaviors that we start getting in. It's so unhealthy.
Is it like you're trying to get your power back or your autonomy back in some way?
100%. You feel like, and I've talked about this a lot on TikTok, like especially in the romantic relationship and, you know, in the family system as well, they make you feel like you're a child that doesn't know how to make your own decisions. And covert narcissists especially can be very patronizing. Like, oh, that's cute. You thought that you should do that way. Or, oh, you're just so naive. Like, why would you have done it? Like, it's very patronizing. And you wait, that's not the way to do it. Like, it could be like something stupid, like you go out for dinner and you know, maybe you're at a, like, I'm trying to think, like, maybe you're at a sushi joint and it's like more deluxe and you eat it this certain way and your friend is like, oh, that's so cute. You've never been to a high-end sushi place before. You don't eat it that way. You just look so stupid. Like, and they do it with a smile and meanwhile, they're like literally tearing you down over sushi. Like,
yeah,
really, this is what's important right now.
But the one time it's like, okay, but with a covert narcissist it happens on multiple occasions and then they make you doubt your reality too. I didn't get quite that. I got more he doesn't love you, he doesn't care about you, how can you not see that he's using you? Like, as if I'm stupid and I can't see when someone's being manipulative. I don't know. It's just little things here and there.
Well, that's the combination of, I would suspect, she's envious that you have a relationship and it's going well. Like, they competition with them, especially in the friendship. Oh, that is very real and alive.
Yeah.
Like, they do not want you to have better than them. They do not want you to be better than them. One of the things that they do that's very sneaky is if you're having, like, let's say that you're having some kind of crisis, their crisis is bigger. Like, it's always louder. It's always more important. And so she wouldn't have wanted you to have this relationship, but it's also taking supply away from her. So
yeah,
if you are prioritizing this romantic relationship because she's pathological in her mind, no, I am in charge. I am in control of you. Because they don't see us as people with needs and feelings and wants, guys. Like, to them, it's transactional. They see us as a means to an end. That's why in the narc family, the narcissistic parent puts you into a role. It's, you're not this little human that they're raising, that they love and they're curious about. They're like, how do you serve me? Are you going to mirror me and lift me up? Okay, cool. You're the golden child. Are you the kid that is staying out of the way? You're invisible. You're very easily manipulated. Perfect. You're my lost child. Or are you the kid that speaks up and tells the truth and fights back? Ooh, you're going to be a problem. You're my scapegoat. You're the one mm-hmm. that gets all the... That's the way they think. They don't think like, here's a person. Aren't they lovely? They're so creative. They're thoughtful. They're artistic. They write well. Like, they don't think about that at all.
No.
It's not even on
there. No. It's insane, like, to me, you talking about family dynamics. And we were talking about this earlier before we start recording, how we go from family dynamic to all these different other tunnels, as you explained it, to different relationships. And I can 1,000% agree with that, because I don't talk about family too much on TikTok or anything, but I know I grew up in a narcissistic family dynamic. It's unreal, and I'm seeing it a lot more now that I'm planning a wedding.
And I think, you know, for me, my big thing with everybody in the healing is, you know, when it's what I'm doing in my own healing journey is, we've got to get to the root. We've got to get to the foundation. If we really, like, if somebody builds a building on quicksand, it doesn't matter how many, you know, fortresses they put in the building or new, you know, concrete, like, it doesn't matter. If the foundation is quicksand, the building is going to sink over and over and over again. So we have to tear it all down. We've got to, like, go beyond just the branches, and we've got to get to the trunk and the tree root. And often a lot of people, the tree root is wired in attachment. It's wired in your earliest relationships. And that for a lot of people is really intimidating and really painful. And they don't want to think about maybe my upbringing. I mean, that was my big thing. When I got diagnosed with CPTSD, I was simultaneously so validated when I found out what it was. I was like, oh mm-hmm. my God, this is everything. It's not just that I'm an anxiety case, but it was also the dissonance was intense, because for me, it was like, look, I grew up, you know, I'm over here in British Columbia in Canada. I'm in Victoria. I'm in a really nice city. You know, I had a home. I had a family. My parents were married. I have a sibling. We had a yard. We went to Disneyland. I had mm-hmm. birthday parties. You know, like, looking from the outside in, CPTSD, narc family, come on now. Like, so it screwed with my head, because what is on the surface, what's in the branches of the tree, everything looks great. But once we got into the tree trunk and into the foundation, I was like, oh boy, it's a lot like the covert narcissist. Sneaky, quiet, insidious. It was not
like picture perfect in a way.
Like narcissistic families are very concerned about image. So the enabling parent is, they're the orchestrator of making sure that not only is the narcissist protected from accountability and the scapegoat is blamed for everything, they're painting a very beautiful picture to the world. And so any child in that family system who is being abused, it is impossible for this child who is dependent on their parents for safety and survival to see it for what it is. Like, you are essentially trapped there. So you're like, well, we get birthday presents. We're not being beaten to death. So I must be a complete freak. And that's the danger of it, right? It's the same concept as chips. Anyways, blah, blah, blah.
So what? No, this is all fascinating. What is your belief? Because I've heard this a lot and I want to get your take on it. I've heard that if you have more of a mother wound, or you grew up with like a narcissistic mother or a mother that's competing with you, that you're more likely going to have friends that are narcissistic. And if you've grown up with a father wound, you're going to go for a man that is more narcissistic. Do you believe in that? Or do you think that that's just, you know, a story that we tell?
I don't think that it's a story per se. I think that I believe that it's not black and white. And I think that absolutely could be true. 100% it could be true, but I don't think that it's going to be true in all cases. At the end of the day, often people that end up in narcissistic relationships, more often than not, but not always, are people who have been wired to maneuver those relationships. However, because of the manipulation tactics that a narcissistic person uses, they can manipulate somebody who's more securely attached that doesn't have mother wounds or father wounds, but it's less likely, and I'll tell you why. A securely attached person does not have the same, they don't have the same need to work so hard for love and approval. So the second they're met with some of these manipulation tactics, a healthy, secure person goes, dude, what the hell are you doing? They're secure in themselves. They're secure in who they are. They're secure in being able to speak up, because as a child, their emotions were validated.
Yeah.
Their experiences were validated. They learned that they can ask for help. They learned that help was accessible and that they mattered. So when someone makes them feel like they don't matter, they're like, bro, what the hell is this? Whereas people like me, that was not my reality. My needs and emotions were dismissed, minimized, invalidated. I was told I'm stupid and I'm exaggerative and all the different things. And so carrying that belief around when another human being says the same thing, well, I learned that that was true. So I'm going to believe them and I'm going to work a lot for their love and approval. And that's the danger.
Wow. Wow. That's, I don't know. This whole conversation has like really honestly resonated with me. So thank you. I feel like this was very therapeutic for me.
I love that. That's what they say about me in the community is that I am the encyclopedia that takes very complex subjects and breaks it down to smaller.
I love that. No, I really love that. I mean, I've watched a lot of your videos and sometimes I find myself like looking at the screen being like, yes.
That makes me happy. It's like, I didn't go through all this crap for nothing. My background is healthcare and I have a teacher. I have a Bachelor of Education. So I've actually taught in a classroom and teaching is my fire. It's my passion. I love, like, my favorite thing in the world is if somebody, you know, is like, oh my God, like, why does he do that? Or why does she do this? And then I explain it and I see the light go on. Like, you had a couple of those moments.
Yeah. I was like, what?
No, I get so excited because my entire experience was this lack of validation. Like, I felt like I was the issue. I felt like there was something wrong with me. I felt like my experience was not my reality. And so because I know what that felt like, it's deeply personal for me. So when I see another victim get that light bulb moment, like that, like it's like floss for my soul. I'm like, yes. Like, yes. Giving you people the things that I didn't get. And it makes me really happy, honestly.
No, I can relate to that. I relate to that on the front, like friendship, whenever I have clients that talk about friendships that have really destroyed them. I feel for them And I feel for them where they don't feel validated, because I feel like when it comes to friendships, people are quick to dismiss it and be like, oh, you must be in love with her, as if romantic feelings only matter. Or you get the, it's just a friend, get over it. Like, they've moved on. Why haven't you? And it's like, because they abused me, honey. But it's like one of those things.
It's people, I go back to what I said earlier about the Sandra Elbero thing. People don't understand abuse dynamics. I mean, even when I got out of my abusive relationship, you know, it was classic. Like, I was very isolated. There was a lack of support. And, you know, given my family dynamics, there were problems there. And I said to my mom, I said, you know, people know that domestic violence and abuse, and they know that all these things exist. Like, they're aware of that part of it. Mm-hmm. But the wall that they put up for themselves because of their own discomfort, they don't think that it will happen to them. And they certainly don't think that it'll necessarily happen to someone they know. And so when it happens to someone that they know and they're not equipped, they do not have the toolkit to know what to do with this person, instead of them owning that and saying, wow, I am so sorry that happened to you. I have no idea how to help you in a way that's productive, because this is skill set that's beyond me. People are proud. People are self-serving. So they use that discomfort to avoid the situation, to preserve their own feelings. If more people could just learn that, guys, if you don't know about abuse dynamics, that's not a bad thing. That doesn't make you some fat.
It means it's okay.
Yes, but it exists.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I would have loved someone just to be like, hey, I don't know about abuse or emotional trauma. I don't know any of that. But if I could just be there to listen to you or be a shoulder to cry on, like, that's all you need, honestly. It's just someone to, like, listen without, you know, without telling you what you need to do. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, and that is what it boils back down to, the discomfort. Mm-hmm. Like, I will reference, there are some people that will say, you know, like, oh, why didn't I, like, but Brené Brown, she talks about shame and vulnerability, but she talks about leaning into the discomfort. And
yes,
a lot of people are painfully terrified of discomfort. It's people that, what if they decide that they want to get in shape and they go to the gym and they're like, wow, this is really hard lifting that weight up, or like having my heart race and like breathing, you know, really heavy to do the cardio. That's really uncomfortable. I don't like the way this feels, so I'm going to stop. Like, there are unfortunately a lot of people that don't have a lot emotional muscle. Like, if you don't use your emotions and you don't lean into discomfort, your emotional ability, you're going to atrophy. And there are unfortunately a lot of people out there that these subjects are intense. They are deep. They are, they're a lot for people. And so instead of them being curious about it, they turn the other way. That's why abuse victims feel so isolated and alone, is because people are, not always, but there are a lot of people that'll just, well, that's uncomfortable for me. Don't like that. See ya. And it's
yes. Sad. It's sad. It's true though. But I feel like there's a lot of healing in leaning into shame. I 1000% agree to that. I think I've healed the most when I, you know, they say look at your shadows, but it's leaning into the darkest parts of you that you don't want to look at. I don't know. I that has helped me move forward a lot.
Yep. I call it the box in the corner that no one wants to open. We all have a box in the corner. It's our deepest, darkest secrets. It's the place that we know, every person knows that it's there. Because even if you're a securely attached person, you probably have a box that is not as dark and not as scary and doesn't have as many cobwebs. But you know, people that have gone through really crappy things, we have that box in the corner that we don't want to open. And to start the work, you have to just be brave enough to take the first step. Just go open the box. You're not going to sort it out in one day. It's going to take time, but you will become the person that you want to be in the world. Like that's the key to all this, is that I'm not doing all this work so that I can, like, you know, blame my family and blame the world and externalize. It's like, no, I live in an internal prison having CPTSD. It's a horrible experience. And so I don't want to have that experience anymore. So I'm like, how do I heal in a way that brings me to a place of purpose, which is what I'm doing right now, having this conversation with you. I'm leaning into my purpose, and also getting to a place where I, you know, have a sense of inner peace. I'm not in chaos. I'm not questioning myself. I'm not picking horrible relationships. Or even if I do, I don't blame myself. I notice and I go, hey, we know this movie now. We've seen this movie. We don't want to get to the
end. Yeah, we know how it ends.
So, you know, go back to 1986, press eject on the VHS, then take it back to Blockbuster. I don't want that one. Blockbuster,
though. I wish it was still here. No, that I think I'm going to steal that from you. That was good.
Good. I just came up with it on the spot. I've never dropped that before, but here we are.
Woo! We get it first time. I love it. I love it. All right. So we are coming to a close with the podcast, but I am going to put you on the spot one more time, ask you one more question, and it's for everyone. Your interpretation of the first warning signs, or whatever red flags you want to call it, for covert narcissists, and what to look out for when you're meeting them in person.
I think with a so we know that narcissistic people, they mirror a lot, and they, you know, they make you feel really special. And I hesitate to tell people that that's a red flag, because when I meet somebody that I really connect with, because I'm neurodivergent, I can get way too excited, and I can get into this, like, oh my God, me too. Like, you love Disney too. Like, I can kind of do some of the stuff that a narcissistic person might do. But this is the thing I tell people, that is going to be really, really, really clear cut with any narcissistic person, even if it's just a person who has very, very, very toxic traits. They might not necessarily be full scope NPD.
Mm-hmm.
The very first time you say, No, I don't want to go to that concert. No, I don't want to eat that. No, I would prefer not to have another drink. A person who is healthy will always respect your agency, your autonomy, and your boundaries. They will not try to push them or make it about them. Someone who is narcissistic does not like you having agency or autonomy. They are concerned with power and control. So the very first red flag is going to be a person that says, oh, you're not going to have another drink. Oh, you're such a buzzkill. It's that simple. Now, that doesn't mean that they're fully narcissistic, but that is your first limbic system yellow light. That's like, hold on, I don't like that.
Yeah.
That's a sign.
Wow. Okay. So it's being able to say no to somebody. I like that. Yeah. I like that. I feel like also with the mirroring part, at least from what I've noticed, and please correct me if I'm wrong, they do mirror you, but it's never the truth. Like, I understand the excitement. Like, if you and me like Disney movies, Disney princesses, and we'd be like, oh my God, I love it too, because it's true for me, it's true for you. But I feel like with a narcissistic person, you'd say you love Disney movies. And if I were to be narcissistic, I would say, yeah, me too. But I would never watch. I don't know anything about Disney princesses. I don't know anything about Disney. Like, I would lie. That's at least that's what I've seen narcissists do, is they mirror you, but they lie. They pretend.
Yeah, they mirror you and they lie. So, like, as an example, a quick example, because I know that you want to wrap this up, but when I first started talking to Peggy, he told me that he loved the outdoors and he loved hiking. After I told him that I loved the outdoors and I loved hiking. Well, that was completely false. He likes to go on a walk on a flat trail wearing a very nice getup. But they also will mirror you in a way where they twist their own narrative. So if they extrapolate something from you that they know, ooh, this is really important to her or him, this is something that happened, they will take something in their own life that maybe happened a little bit that way, but they twist it. I told him that my ex-husband discarded, he was a covert narcissist. He discarded me for a 19-year-old girl. He left the marriage. Wow. And I told him really early on that that was like part of how I got CPTSD, blah, 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 like the diagnosis. And he was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I was engaged to somebody before you and the relationship ended because she cheated on me with this person. So we had this like instant, oh my God, soul connection. Well, I found out after we got married and as the relationship went on, that was not true. He took pieces of information and plunked it into a timeline that was convenient for him to construct a narrative to mirror me.
Wow. Yeah. So basically just coerced you into the relationship.
Expert love bomber, expert mirror, expert. And I mean, again, like we could be here until Christmas if I went on, but
honestly, same. I could continue talking about this for like 4 hours more.
Immigration was his weapon. The pandemic was his weapon. Peggy had a lot of things that he was able to weaponize to his advantage to not only make me dependent on him, but to literally entrap me in his prison. Very dangerous.
Wow.
But here I am.
We made it. I mean, you're strong. Your story is incredible. And I mean, not incredible in a way where it's like, yay. But incredible, yeah, incredible that you share it. And I know that there's so many people that like respect you and love the fact that you're sharing this story and you're reaching out and talking about this. It was lovely to have you on the podcast. And I hope we can do another one because like I just want to pick your brain.
Anytime. I would love to. I'm very honored to be.
But this has been great. To anyone listening, if you have any questions for Kelly, where can they reach you at?
So I am on TikTok. I'm Kelly CPTSD trauma and educator, but I'm Tinker Kellyda. I have apparently multiple fake accounts. So don't go to the fake account. It'll be pretty obvious not to say, I don't know how to say that. It's the one that has the largest following. Let's just be honest about that.
Yes.
I'm also on Instagram. I'm trying to build my community there. I'm Tinker Kelly. Yes, there's a Disney theme here on Instagram. Instagram is a bit more like a day in the life of Kelly as opposed to all teaching. But those are the places that you can find me now. I'm currently writing a book. It's a big thing that people in the community know about. I'm actually now on chapter 2. So we're as soon as I launch that'll be a big deal. I'll be advertising that. And we'll see what else comes my way.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being on the show. I'm so excited. And and we will end this here and talk soon. Love you guys. Bye.